Well, David Walliams is an extraordinary talent, an actor, comedian, writer, television personality. He's coming to South Africa because he's written a slew of incredible children's books. I actually spoke to a friend of mine today, and she told me that her five children are all absolutely in love with David's books. My own two nephews are just as excited about the fact that I'm going to bring them some of his books. And here he is to tell us all about it. David Walliams, it's such a pleasure to see you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Exceedingly well. I'm more happy than you can imagine for having you. And I'm so fucking excited to see you, actually. I can't contain myself. No, I mean, look, the books are amazing, and I do want to talk about them because I know that's why you're talking to us. But there's so much other stuff that I'd love to pick your brain on. Oh. Either way, congratulations on the success of all of these books. They've been a tremendous phenomenon. And I mean, did you know that you would end up writing children's books at any point, or is this just something that came along?
Well, I'm just thinking that I've been writing professionally for about 30 years, and 15 of those years have been writing books for children. So it's been a big part of my career, but I was so focused in the early part of my career on being, you know, trying to create successful comedy shows for television. I wasn't really thinking about it other than being a fan of children's books as an adult, you know, just loving reading as many children's books as I could, because when you become an adult, you realize there's quite a lot of good children's books that you've missed because you weren't the right age or you never got around to actually reading them. So I was reading a lot and thinking, oh, I've got an idea for a children's story. Maybe I should have a go. You know, might be interesting. Someone might want to read it. That was The Boy in the Dress. That was 15 years ago. And I think there's been about 40 titles since then. So I've been busy. But I do love it. And it's not that different to what I was doing before in terms of it's still writing, creating characters, making jokes, those kind of things. It's just a kind of emotional dimension that I didn't do before, because you can't really do emotions much in comedy sketches.
Well, I beg to differ. You even used the word try just now. And I mean, you've been successful as all more in that pursuit as well. But what I love about these books, and what I used to love as a kid, I loved, there's the inevitable comparison with Roald Dahl, which I'm not sure if you're happy with that or you're unhappy with it. But from my
point of view, happy. I imagine he's unhappy.
Well,
he
I
is
think
rolling in his grave.
I don't know. I think Roald Dahl and you have a lot in common, and it's not just that you shared the illustrator Quentin Blake, which I recognized immediately from my own childhood, but it is also, it's in the style. You take your reader seriously. You know, Roald Dahl never pandered to children. He never sort of spoke to them in humiliating child speak, and you do the same thing. I mean, you've got great stories.
He never patronized them, and I think that's what I'm saying. Love it about it. And also people forget that children are quite aspirational. So when you're 10, you want to read a book that's really for like 12-year-olds. And when you're 12, you want to watch an 18 film. And it just is the way it is. So if you make a really cutesy story about Harry the Hedgehog, you know, people, kids beyond about 6 probably aren't that interested, because it just sounds kind of cutesy. But to read something that feels forbidden, that you're reading under the covers with a torchlight, and, you know, you think maybe my parents would totally approve because it's a bit rude or a bit scary. Yeah. I think that's a better thing. And also, you know, children are sophisticated, and they know the entertainment they want is, I don't think they want things that feel childish. And I think that's the most important thing, not to underestimate them. And I suppose that's what I learned from him. But I wouldn't put myself in the same universe as talent as him.
No, no. It seems like they're selling like hotcakes all over the world, which is...
But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're as good, are they? I mean, there's plenty of brilliant writers who don't necessarily sell millions of books, and lots of bad writers who do, so... So I can't go, oh, well, I've told these books, I must be brilliant. You just got to listen to your own instincts. And if I'm happy with it, then I kind of think, well, maybe it's good. Maybe I want to share it with people. But I can't really be my own critic. Other people can get on with that if they want to.
I just love the fact that there's also that you hinted at it already, that little bit of naughtiness, that little bit of things that are disgusting or things that kids shouldn't talk about, that all the prim and proper moms and dads might say, I don't know if that's appropriate. And you kind of go there. And I think children love that because it does feel as if they're going into forbidden territory.
Yes. And but what I would say about that is even if kids are reading something that's like feels a little bit edgy in some way, obviously you don't want them reading 50 Shades of Grey, but if they're reading something a little edgy like The Witches or something, I mean, most of all, you'd be pleased that they're reading with all the distractions they have now. But I think, you know, I'm not sure you would exactly sort of disapprove exactly. I don't really know. We often assume that there's other people who have, who think in a certain way that they want to censor everything and moralize about everything. But I don't really know anyone like that. And I don't know if you do, but I don't know if people seriously disapprove of things like Roald Dahl book. I can't think that they would.
No, I don't think that there are a lot of people in my life or necessarily in yours like that, but I certainly think they exist. And you've encountered lots of them through the course of making shows like Little Britain, you know, things that you took the piss out of, things which now I think people are tremendously sensitive about. And I don't know if you could make shows like that anymore. I don't know if you could write certain books anymore. You mentioned 50 Shades of Grey. I think, you know, there'd be a lot of...
I've read it, so I don't know much about it, but I know what the story is vaguely, but I've read it. Read it, and my mum's AC.
Well, I think it's probably just a little bit of slap and tickle, and maybe it gets a bit extreme. But you know, there'd be people who'd say, "Oh, well, it's abusive and all of that stuff."
I haven't read it, but you know, it was written by a woman, and it's a sort of fantasy of sorts, isn't it? But I just think, I suppose we're just more sensitive. But something like Little Britain, it was satirizing Britain of 20 plus years ago, and if you were making it now, it'd be different because you'd be satirizing this moment in time. Sensitivities are different. But every day someone comes up and says, "Oh, is there going to be more Little Britain? Oh, we're loving it." And a new generation is all the time are discovering it. I think Come Fly With Me is like number one or two often in like most downloaded TV shows on iTunes. That's like about... was it? I don't know, like me getting on for about 15 years since it was made. So what can I say? I mean, there's still a big audience for things. And if you look at like Netflix comedians like Dave Chappelle or Ricky Gervais or Jimmy Carr, people like edgy stuff, don't they? I mean, it's still, they're the probably the biggest comedians on Netflix. I don't know about you, but when I hear something's controversial, I immediately want to see it, listen to it, whatever, because it's interesting. You know, and some art sets out to shock and offend. I mean, if you're the Sex Pistols or the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, or you're certain artists with Tracy Emin or something, I mean, that part shocking is part of what you're trying to do. So, I mean, Ricky Gervais is, I watched that really bit. I mean, I wasn't shocked exactly, but I kind of understand that it's got shock value. And those things are wildly popular. So I don't think those things are going away. You know, I don't think there'll be a time when no one can have fun. I mean, I always think it's like different strokes for different folks. I always think Life of Brian is probably my favorite comedy film ever.
Yeah,
I love it, but if you were the Pope, you probably wouldn't. Don't worry about it. Yeah, so it's not for the Pope.
Well,
I like it, just as I wouldn't. You know, I watched Austin Powers movie with my son, who loves it, and my mum watched it as well. She didn't like it, but it was like, well, okay, fine. She's not to watch the next one, does she? I mean, we thought it was hilarious. She didn't, but you know, so what? It's a bit rude. It's sort of cheeky and cartoony, but. Yeah, I don't know. With the weird idea that we all have to consume the same art at the same time and have the same opinion about it just seems kind of crazy and unworkable.
Well, you sort of, I read this in a hurry just before because I thought, actually, it looks like I could probably manage it in about 5 seconds. And I got through it. I loved it. This is just, there's a snake in my school. And I think the theme of that was also be as individual as you can. Mm. It's okay to have a python. Of course, the headmistress gets eaten, spoiler alert, but that's the kind of thing that kids love. They want their headmistress, the wicked Mrs. whatever her name was, to be eaten.
Yeah, well, that's fun and exciting, isn't it? I would think also, we read the thing, if that happened in real life, it would be horrifying. But in the context of a story, it's okay. And I think it's the same with lots of things, with jokes, whatever. It's like, if that was real, you know, then that would be really disturbing. But it's not real, and you know it's not real. So you're probably going to be okay with it.
So I do have to, before we move on from Little Britain, just tell you that when I posted a picture of me and my co-host on a show as Bubbles and Desiree once from Little Britain, I was actually banned from Facebook. And that was in the early days when you were...
Good. I agree with that. I mean, I would just ban you anyway, regardless of who you dress up. I wouldn't have any compunction about that.
So we were banned, thanks to you and Matt Lucas. I had to start a new account, which...
That means you were sort of banned forever. It just means that you escaped through the net.
I think someone banned it on the grounds of nudity because you had those prosthetic boots on.
Yeah, well, I'm with Facebook on this. I think we should be.
Well, I also have to say that I've got a friend called Emily.
Don't believe that for a second.
No. We ended up calling her Emily Howard just because of your show. I still call her Emily Howard to this day. In fact, I was the MC at her wedding and told everyone her name was really Emily Howard. The people in the crowd who got it, which was a majority, thought it was very, very funny. But that's an interesting character too. And I mean, the boy in a dress, which is such an interesting idea. There are all these changes that have happened in society too. And characters like Emily Howard, I mean, I think it was made with a very kind of poking fun, but at the same time, not being nasty. It was never mean.
No, it was really innocent. But also, I think we've changed how we see that. Because I was playing a transvestite, and the definition of a transvestite is someone who cross-dresses for pleasure.
Right.
And now we talk much more about trans issues in more general ways. So we're now talking about people who are struggling with their gender identity, which is not something we were depicting. So it's quite, you know, it's just worth keeping an eye on what you were doing, just because it was just perceived a bit differently 20 years ago. But that's what we were doing. And the joke of the sketch was, you know, Emily Howard keeps kind of giving herself away a bit by kind of overcompensating. And that was what the joke was. But, you know, with all our characters, I feel they were like quite fun and celebratory, and you wanted to spend time with them because they were like funny characters. But yeah, I think if you would represent, you know, if you were doing a joke about someone who was transgender, that's different, isn't it? But that she's not transgender, she's transvestite.
I'm not trying to
think they're really different things, and certainly the perception of it 20 years ago was, and, it was on pencil cases and stuff like that, so I think if people had really thought it was really kind of worrying in some way, it wouldn't have been on pencil cases and rulers, stationery sets and lunch boxes and stuff like that. People would have thought, you know, so that's it. So some sort of attitudes have changed. But, I mean, most people don't worry about this kind of stuff because they've got other stuff to think about and worry about. And I think it opens a more general thing of like, art from the past that we now, you know, wouldn't quite be done now. But what are we going to do? Are we going to edit every movie? Are we going to... I mean, we just drive ourselves mad. And I remember growing up, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and my dad was really into, like, Humphrey Bogart movies that we watched, and sort of old Bond movies and stuff. And the way that women are treated in movies from, well, the past 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s is really different. And I remember I found things jarring. You know, Humphrey Bogart slaps a woman across the face, and it's, you know, it's really jarring. But what are we going to do? We're going to edit those, suppress those movies, edit those movies. They're of their time. And I think you can only really understand kind of art in the context of its time, unless it's completely timeless for whatever reason. Like it doesn't happen. It's not about, you know, modern life in any way. And it tells us about the past. It's interesting. You know, Charles Dickens tells us about what life was like 200 years ago. It wasn't the same. But just imagine going through Charles Dickens and putting lines through things that we would just think wouldn't do that now, you know. It's just like an endless kind of thing, isn't it, where we'd have to dismantle everything that ever happened. It's a task. And then in 5 years' time, we'd have to do it all again. Because in 5 years' time, it would be some different kind of feeling about the world and new issues would have come to the fore.
I certainly didn't bring it up because this is like the BBC hard talk, and I expect you to, you know, go through your conscience about things that I loved every second of it. I can see it in context. And I think that these children's books will have an element of timelessness to them. I mean, they're probably things in Roald Dahl, and you've been criticized too, probably things in Roald Dahl that people would look at and go, oh, I don't know about that. I mean, Astro Chimp, which you're about to launch too, and I think you're coming to South Africa to bring it here for the first time.
And actually the book is coming out in South Africa first, which is fantastic. Yeah, because I'm doing these festivals, and obviously I thought it'd be nice for people to get the book first, and then, you know, I get a chance to talk about it and people get to actually read it. So that's exciting, and I'm glad that is happening because it makes it a bit more special, because kids generally want the new book, you know, as soon as they can. So it's nice they're getting it first.
Well, I mean, the reason I bring it up is also because there would probably be some kind of animal rights activist somewhere, some lunatic fringe type personality who would say, well, you know, you're actually drawing on some terribly cruel things when we sent all these animals to space once. And the idea is that all of them, you know, kind of get together in space and do things, which is quite cool.
In my book, they're all still alive. But I mean, I've not really heard that. I mean, the first animals that sent into space was 1948. And they were flies, and so they wouldn't be alive now anyway. But again, I mean, it's like a fantasy. I think people thought it was it's sad that some of these animals died in space, you know, cold or hunger. I mean, it is sad. But I'm not representing that. I'm saying it's like Star Wars in space, it's like Star Wars with animals, and I've created new names, new identities for the characters, and they're all still alive. So I'm not really getting into the morality of sending a chimp or a dog into space. I'm just writing a fantasy, which is the starting point.
Do you think that the kids they need to be persuaded to read now, because all these devices have made things a lot more busy, and there are so many other options, and, you know, there's animation and there's video, and a lot of parents, I suppose, just plop their kids in front of some device, and there's a world of real excitement in literature, and especially in kids' books that activate the imagination. There's a magic to that that you just don't get from a screen.
Oh, I completely agree. Yeah, because I think with books, you have to work, you have to think, you paint the images in your head. But it's also it's a more intimate experience, because it's just the writer and the reader, you know, having this communication with each other. And so it is a special thing. I think it is hard to get kids to read, but I would say the biggest thing is trying to get kids to read for pleasure. Because if you know, we all had to read books in school, and, you know, if that was taught well, it would be interesting and exciting. And I had great teachers, so we, you know, read Shakespeare plays and stuff, and I loved those lessons. You know, a lot of people would think, oh, having to study Shakespeare would be some kind of chore, but the teacher brought it alive in an amazing way. But I'm slightly digressing, but I'm saying, if your child wants to pick up a book or a graphic novel or a comic or whatever, that's a great thing, because they want to read. They are a reader. And if they don't read as a child, the child side won't read as an adult. And you just miss out on so much, you know. There's so much information and entertainment in books that, and the way books work is just different to other things. It's not just a story, and it'd be better if it was a film. It's something else is going on in the way that you consume it. So that's what I see really as my mission, which is to get kids reading and for pleasure. You know, I don't regard these books, and nor does anyone else, by the way, as great works of literature. I do my absolute best to make them entertaining and funny and scary and, you know, full of adventure and life. But I feel like when I go into schools and talk to kids, I realize that trying to get kids to read is a big deal. And so I kind of think it's fun to have books that are just there to entertain and get kids to read. And then when they're really, once they've been reading my books, maybe they want to move on to things that are, you know, might be considered sort of intellectual or literary in some way, and that's great. But I feel like you've got to start your reading journey. And also, even though, like, I like to watch, you know, Truffaut films and Fellini films and all kinds of things, but I also really like watching Anchorman. So, you know, sometimes you're in the mood for, you know, something intellectual, and sometimes you're in the mood for something that is just going to make you laugh, entertain you. So I kind of think, I'm not sure if you just move, you go, oh, well, my child's now reading, you know, this book that's considered literature, and then they're never going to read something fun again. Then I'm in the mood to write and watch and read something.
Yeah.
It's like we are. I mean, you know, you read sort of silly books and you read, like, you know, History of the Third Reich, and there's just, you know, that's, you were in the mood for something else, weren't you? You know, you can't just heavy
you can't start with Dostoevsky. You've got to give yourself a little bit of asterisk.
No, that's it. You know, you're going to turn off. I mean, the thing is, I think you just got to be mindful that you can turn off kids forever to books, to reading, to Shakespeare, whatever it is, if it seems boring to them. And so I did have great teachers at school who, you know, inspired us to Shakespeare, but there was one or two whose approaches weren't quite as powerful and persuasive as the others. And I'd look around and I'd see the boys in my class rolling their eyes looking bored. And I thought, the sort of shame that this is, looking back, is that these kids, their worst nightmare would be being taken to see Shakespeare play on stage. Literally the number one thing they would never want to do in their life. And I just think, probably they didn't have an exciting enough introduction to it, and it was just like a chore to them to have to, you know, for them to have to study it. And so it's sort of, for them, it drained the life out of them. So I think it's to entertain people does have a big value. And I always thought what I'm trying to do is like sugarcoat the pill, in that I'm writing something, you know, like The Boy in the Dress, where it's like, it does deal with an issue that, you know, quite interesting and serious, and, you know, which is about a boy dressing as a girl and going to school. But at the same time, it does have some fun in it. It does have some laughter in it. It does have some over-the-top characters. It's not just an issue. It's a story where this issue emerges from the story. And so I think that's kind of how, you know, that's a good way of approaching writing for anybody, but especially children, to be trying to deal with something kind of serious and interesting, but at the same time making sure it's still entertaining. Otherwise, you're not going to get anywhere with
it. Is it difficult to write these books, and what's the process? I mean, is there quite a lot of to and fro with editing, or is it actually for you?
Yeah, there's a lot of work in editing. I mean, the edits, you work with an editor, and then first of all, you get the big notes to do with story or character or whatever, themes, those kind of things. And then the notes get smaller and smaller each time, and then they just become about grammatical errors and things like that. But I love doing it. I think getting started on a new story is hard, because you think, oh, you're looking at a mountain going, oh, I've got to climb it. Because you haven't got anything yet, and you don't really know, you plan things, you know, the characters are, you know what the story is, but you haven't put it into action yet. You don't know it's necessarily going to work. And so at first it's like a chore, which is why a lot of people prevaricate. A lot of people say to me, oh, I'd love to write a book, but they've never started one.
And I kind of get that because it's intimidating to start a book. But at the same time, you just have to start. Otherwise, that book will never get written. But I plan out the story. I make lots of notes. I've just written a murder mystery for kids. And I had to plan that out in immense detail because I had to know the plot was going to work because, you know, a plot like that has twists and turns and a secret, you know, the murderer has got to, you know, you just got to create a very intricate story like a house of cards where, you know, we're surprised about what happened, but it still makes sense afterwards. So, I planned that in huge detail, and it was about half the length. The plan was about half the length of the actual book. You know what I mean? It was like a 10,000 word treatment, and I wanted to make sure that was completely right. So I counseled my book editor, and he said, "Can you see any holes in this? Because I don't want to write this and realize the whole thing has been a massive mistake."
Well, it makes you appreciate Agatha Christie, right? I mean, you really
amazing. I mean, properly brilliant twist. I mean, when I watched Murder on the Orient Express when I was a kid, the Sidney Lumet version, like Sean Connery and Anthony Perkins and everyone in it, I was like absolutely bamboozled by it. I thought it was incredible. So I do respect her, and also the fact that she didn't just write one. She wrote like, I don't know, it was something like nearly 100 books or something. And you go, wow, so you had 100 great ideas for plots, and you had all these twists, and it's like, it's incredible, extraordinary. So yes, I did have, I mean, I always respected her, but I had more respect. So I thought, blimey, this is hard work. And also she used to do it a couple a year. And also I kind of think about the way people had to write in the past where they didn't have computers.
Mm.
So, you know, I mean, I think about Shakespeare, this is quite
imagine.
I mean, you wouldn't be a lot of rewriting, and then Agatha Christie's just typing away. And you think, it's much harder, I think, than on a computer where you've got so much more, it's so easy to cut and paste and change things.
Change a word or something. I mean, you'd have to throw away the whole page.
Yes. So I'm really glad I didn't have to type because, I mean, I actually saw the manuscript for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. His own manuscript is at the Roald Dahl Museum in Great Missenden, where he lived. And he, at the last minute, changed the Oompa Loompas were originally called Whipple Scrumpets. And just at the last minute, he must have had a better idea. But he had to go through the whole of the manuscript, cross out Whipple Scrumpets each time, actually, as I mentioned, and like, you know, little arrow, Oompa Loompas. So that now would take me like 10 seconds, you know, find and replace. But then it probably took him like a good hour or so to go through it. So it's quite interesting, the different, you know, the techniques. It just makes me think how difficult it must have been. And also, it's quite interesting to think about, like, Dickens. He was writing these chapters would come out in kind of weekly or monthly publications.
In the newspaper, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'm not sure he always necessarily had, you know, he probably was publishing these as he went along. So it's quite an interesting way to write without, you know, having finished the whole thing and then putting it out there. It's just interesting to me.
And I wonder with people like Arthur Conan Doyle, because they used to also write these periodic into, you know, to these little inserts in the newspaper or whatever. And I often wonder if they had the plan at the very start, as you had to.
They must have done with like murder mysteries, because again, with Sherlock Holmes, there's brilliant twists. I think if he had no idea what the twist could be, he might get himself into some trouble.
Imagine going and having a drink and being hungover and forgetting what the twist was.
Yeah, I know. It'd be awful, wouldn't it? I mean, I'm just guessing. But I mean, I sort of imagine that would be the most sensible way to go about it. Otherwise, you're just going to waste. That's the main thing. I planned it out because I thought, I don't want this whole thing to be a colossal waste of time for me to get to the end and go, oh, this whole thing doesn't work because I haven't thought of something.
Well, I'm excited to read it, but I'm also excited that you're coming to South Africa. Is it your first time here?
it is not my first time. I went to Johannesburg. Actually, it was about 12 years ago. And me and Lara, who became my wife, we were invited by Elton John to go on a safari. So he invited like about 20 friends, and we took over this resort. And we all went out on the game drives and dinners in the evening, and then we go into like local villages. And
wonderful.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It's just funny to be on a safari with Elton John.
Were people looking at
there was something really funny when he was being shown a bird. He went, "We've got birds in England. Show me something big." This is quite funny. You might always remember that. I thought it was quite funny. I was thinking, "Yeah, I'm a bit. I don't really want to see a bird. I want to see an elephant, please, because we don't have those." But no, it's a great country, and I'm really excited to be coming back. And I've just actually been in Spain. I did events out there. And the most mind-blowing thing is when I go to a country where I haven't, done book events and things like that before, it's just meeting people who are kind of fans of you that you just didn't really know existed, you know. And, some of these kids in Spain got quite emotional about meeting me, and I was like, really? This is amazing. It's a very thrilling, it's probably even more pleasurable for me to meet them than that they might have meeting me, because it's just such a thrill to think your stories mean so much to people.
And I mean, 55 languages across the globe, that's quite cool too. I mean, they're probably...
I couldn't name 55 languages. I don't think many people could they? Unless they were like, I don't know, professors of language or something. I only know two, and it's amazing, because it's also interesting that the sort of cultural differences don't seem to get in the way. Like someone told me that Gangster Grainy had sold like a couple of 100,000 copies in China, and right. It's about stealing the crown jewels from the Tower of London, and it's about the Queen, and it's about Strictly Come Dancing and all this kind of stuff. And it's like all these things that I wouldn't imagine that kids in China are necessarily that familiar with. They're living in very different circumstances, very different system there. And yet the story still captures their imagination. So it's very, very pleasing.
That's fantastic. I have World's Worst Children 3 in front of me, and I can't help thinking that there must be some pushy stage mom somewhere who's almost auditioning their children for you as you pass them on the tube or something, and tries to sort of push them in front of you to be a candidate for the next one. Met someone?
What they do is they go, look, it's your favorite author, look. And they go, who, J.K. Rowling? And they go, no, your second favorite author. Because kids sometimes know your name and not your face. But it's very sweet. I see kids, come up, can I just say I really like your books? And it's very, very sweet.
Sweet. That is lovely. And kids are also so honest. If they tell you they like something, they really do.
Well, I think as a grown-up, I think about like, oh, this book has just won majors, or just won the Booker Prize, I really must read it. I don't enjoy it from page one. Page 901. I'm still reading it, not really knowing what's happening. And then I eventually finish it and go, why did I read it? I wasn't enjoying it, but I read it because I thought it was, I'd heard it was amazing, but I just didn't get it. Whereas I think kids, they don't like something, they'd immediately stop, they're not going to waste their time on something they really don't like, unless they're forced to, and so, yeah, it's great. I was thinking you have to grab their imaginations very quickly. You need to make sure that every end of every chapter there's a real hook for them to keep reading. You really need to entertain. You can't lose them. You can't lose their focus, because if you do that, they're just going to give up. And then that's, I don't know, that you don't want the idea that your books, your kids are giving up on your books. Because if they do, they'll never read another one.
Well, you are doing God's work then, my friend, and long may it continue.
I don't think it's ever been called God's work, but I'm trying my best.
I think making children imagine is truly bringing magic back into the world. And whether it's you or J.K. Rowling or Roald Dahl, and you know, bless you for it. I mean, I don't have children, but I've got two nephews who love your stuff. And I mentioned at the start of this that a friend of mine, who I actually just messaged before the interview and said, interviewing David Walliams, and she said, oh my God, she's got five children, the poor woman. And she said, all of her five children have grown up on a diet of your books, and they only have Billionaire Boy. And I said to them, well, fine, I'll bring you another two or three. And she's just delighted. So you're spreading all kinds of good, and keep children reading. I think it's just marvelous. Looking forward to having you in South Africa, David, and thank you for your time today.